One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
This is Ross Coulthart, and you are listening to That UFO Podcast.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to That UFO Podcast. Excited for this one, folks, as I am joined by the Director of Intelligence at Sentinel One, and he's a National Security Fellow at the Bitcoin Policy Institute. I'd like to welcome Matthew Pines. Matt, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you on. You're not my typical guest. I'll say that straight off the bat. And I say that because usually guests come on, they've got a known role in the UFO topic. You know, they've got a book out on it, or they've been involved in research for 30, 40, 50 years. For me, you've kind of came out of nowhere where you'd done a podcast called What Bitcoin Did. You were on for 2 hours with the guys on there discussing all kind of geopolitical situations, Bitcoin, crypto. The last 20 minutes, though, seem to go viral and catch the imagination of a lot of folks online. I'm sure you've seen the clips shared over and over again. And straight away, lots of folks got in touch with me to say, get this guy on. Really, and you spoke so well on that short 20-minute clip, really well on the UFO topic, that I thought I had to get in touch with you. So here we are. Matthew, first off, can you tell us who is Matthew Pines?
Yeah, certainly. So I guess... brief background, right? So I studied physics and philosophy as an undergrad at Johns Hopkins. I was going to be an academic physicist until I decided working in academia wasn't the life for me. You know, did a hard pivot in grad school over at the London School of Economics, where I did a master's in philosophy and public policy. Again, basically stalling while I forgot the rest of my life. Came back to DC, was sort of my sort of home base. Got a fellowship at the National Science Foundation for 2 years, helping support grant programs across economics, decision, risk management sciences, and sort of started to figure out what I wanted to do. I sort of stumbled into doing consulting for the government, working for a small business that had contracts with the U.S. government to do essentially exercises. That was sort of the initial start of the company, essentially war games of all sorts of, you know, low probability, high risk, high consequence scenarios. Sort of evolved through that company, doing a lot of different work as a consultant for the government, mostly in sort of that lane of assessments of sort of tail risk scenarios, doing exercises, but also doing sort of more analytic assessments of national preparedness, thinking through how prepared is the government for all sorts of, you know, bad scenarios, both natural disasters, of course, traditional things, hurricanes, pandemics, you know, earthquakes, but also, you know, big catastrophic other scenarios involving, say, nuclear war, cyber attacks, other sorts of major disruptions. So I've, you know, jumped around through a lot of different programs and did a number of projects, including assessments of emerging technology, sort of field experiments, et cetera. So I've sort of spanned a lot of different domains in my career. I left doing government consulting to join a small startup that was focused on delivering kind of management consulting services at the intersection of geopolitical and cybersecurity risk to multinationals and critical technology companies. A few years ago, I became the director of security intelligence for that firm called the Krebs Stamos Group. And so most of our clients are sort of multinationals, some critical technology companies that either have, you know, direct exposure to sort of geopolitical risk, nation states that are trying to target them, and generally speaking, advise them on sort of geopolitical risk and cyber threat intelligence. And so that company was acquired by SentinelOne, which is a publicly traded cybersecurity company. Everything I'm saying here is my personal opinion, not the company's opinion. And I've been serving a similar role within SentinelOne as part of the strategic advisory group, which is called PinnacleOne. And so that's been my professional career. You know, a lot of it's focused on geopolitical risk intelligence, cybersecurity stuff, emerging technology, policy. So that's kind of my professional background. On the UAP topic, you know, I've been, you know, making my thoughts sort of in public for a while now. So I'd say I started tweeting about this, I don't know, 4 years ago, in parallel with a number of other topics I sort of think out loud about on my Twitter profile. That sort of is, you know, just an area where I sort of share my thoughts on various things. And as I've been invited to, you know, give my perspective on a wide range of different issues over the years and different podcasts, you know, this has been one that I've brought up is sort of, you know, people ask me questions about it because I tweet about it and then I give you my thoughts. So I have been, you know, like any other topic kind of that strikes my fancy, paying close attention to it for a number of years. Maybe this particular clip went viral, but I've been speaking about it on podcasts for at least a year and a half now. In fact, I did a podcast with those same gentlemen exactly a year ago beforehand that was just focused on kind of the David Grush revelations and the contours around the UAP Disclosure Act. So through that process, I've had occasion to kind of have, you know, really develop like high trust personal relationships over a number of years, you know, related to this topic and just kind of follow the breadcrumbs and curiosity and kind of get my arms around this this issue.
I'm sure from that background, people have picked up why you're well placed to talk about this, let alone having a personal interest in it. And like you say, I noticed that on the podcast that you mentioned and the host mentions, you'd spoken to him a year previously, and you even talk about percentage chances that there's such a thing as NHI, and we'll get to, you know, your increase that's happened since then. And I was like, why hasn't this guy gone before? But I think that can be the nature of the internet and things going viral, where you can say something over and over and over, and it just takes something to catch on at the right time with the right person, and it blows up. And kind of here you are. So, and genuinely, you spoke about the topic so well. How far back does that interest go? Were you interested as a kid in UFOs? Was that a kind of long-standing interest or more passive?
Yeah, so I was a huge physics nerd since I was a preteen, and I was that kind of kid that was reading, you know, physics books, you know, in middle school. And, you know, it so happens that I was, you know, reading, you know, a wide range of different things on the sort of early internet, including some of the papers that were published by Hal Puthoff and Jack Sarfati. At the time, I didn't know of their, you know, UAP associations. It was just, you know, I was, you know, casting a wide net, reading lots of different things about kind of heterodox physics approaches. Henry Stapp in particular, who's a Los Alamos physicist. And I'd read, I think in middle school, late middle school, The Hunt for Zero Point. And so my, I guess I'd say, initial orientation towards the UFO topic as a sort of a, you know, a hardcore physics nerd was basically, you know, an assumption these were kind of breakthrough US government sort of platforms. You know, I was assumed that, you know, there was some secret physics research going on, and, you know, in Skunk Works, I, you know, was obsessed with the idea of, you know, whatever the next generation stealth systems we had after reading, you know, Zero Point book. I kind of mostly forgot about it, you know, going to college and becoming a professional, where it was, okay, what do I do with my life? And I didn't really pay too much attention to the topic directly. I'd say, you know, like most people, 2017 was really what perked my interest. Mm-hmm. It sort of reminded me of sort of this early childhood orientation towards, you know, this topic. And I've been paying close attention to it ever since. Not, you know, directly in my professional capacity, but just tracking the storyline, obviously, from the sort of, you know, initial articles, the videos that released, TTSA, the Tom DeLonge stuff. And then obviously since 2020, when kind of formal congressional interest started to become manifest in a number of sort of legislative proposals that have been escalating ever since. So that's kind of been my approach to the subject, is trying to get, you know, at least my arms around the official storyline, right? Trying to get my sense around why is this reaching a certain development at this moment. But yeah, that's kind of my background on it.
So professionally, there seems that there could be a lot of opportunity for the UFO or UAP topic to come in and intersect aspects of your job over the years. Does that ever happen, though?
No, it has never formally crossed my desk. And I'll just say for the record, I've never been briefed into any legacy programs or signed an NDA related to any of those alleged activities. You know, nowhere in my, and I've held a TSSCI, I've had, you know, compartmented accesses, but nothing that I suspect at the time related to this topic. A lot of things on emergent technology, on drones, on counter UAS systems, on space and counter space systems, and, you know, a range of sort of continuity of government program evaluations. But nothing in my professional, you know, experience directly, you know, clued me into anything on this. It's given me context to some of the information that has, you know, come out from, highly respected witnesses and whistleblowers, but nothing directly crossed into that domain since I was working on it.
And that's fair. So listen, let's get right into then some of your comments and questions, and we'll just jump all over as the kind of conversation goes. One of the first things you mentioned in that part of the interview, and the link for the full interview I've included previously on one of the breakdowns, folks, but I'll put it back in here, and I recommend you go and listen to it. It's really, really interesting, especially if you see some of the other stuff within that you might have an interest in. But if not, that last 20 minutes is gold for those of us in the UFO community, because it sounded like one of us sitting out on a podcast, and that's what you come across as, talking about the subject well. Finally, it was represented well in a way that was really pleasing to hear. So thanks for that, Matt. So something you said then was, you know, coming into the summer, there will be some major things happening. So obviously we're looking at a few big milestones here, but do you want to touch on what you're talking about when you're on that pod saying big things are going to be happening?
Yeah, so the context is sort of where we are in, you know, what has been, I guess, colloquially termed kind of this process of disclosure, and, you know, manifested by kind of official actions, right? And so paying attention to what is, you know, really going to be like the linchpin of any future official movement is legislation, right? And so the context for this year is what sorts of inside and outside activities, you know, are in motion or could be in motion to help get the UAPDA passed this year. That seems to be the fulcrum of effort. Obviously, last year was sort of a first wave of pressure, starting with Grush and then Carl Nell validating it, and then the introduction of the UAPDA, senior co-sponsors, bipartisan fashion, obviously got stripped down pretty significantly in the House in conference committee. And so this is part two, or this is the sort of second hit. And so this, I, you know, expect a similar strategy, right? Except to sort of crank up the notch in terms of public pressure, public discourse, you know, in a controlled fashion to try to get sufficient momentum to push the UAPD across the line, while sort of, you know, backroom negotiations always take place on these things as sort of the inside game. So I think to that end, I think some things are coordinated, some things are just, you know, happenstance in terms of various, say, documentary projects that at least I'm aware of have been in the works for a while. Of course, with all sorts of, you know, in the media business, right, you could be close to the final cut and still be months away from actually releasing. So I know those are on the calendar, but those things can always get pushed, you know, months. Obviously, Lou Elizondo's book is the one sort of high confidence release date. We know that's coming out, I think, through the leaked versions of some of those chapters. We know he's going to say some pretty eye-opening things, and he's going to go on a book tour, and he's going to be fully unmuzzled to say a lot of things that he hasn't been able to say publicly for the past, you know, 2+ years. And so I think that will draw, you know, renewed attention in sort of, you might call it, mainstream media discourse and sort of the political discourse as we head into a highly charged presidential campaign season. And yeah, so I think there will be, you know, an increase, you know, these things tend to sort of swing. We'll sort of see a kind of an upswing in the tempo and salience of this topic into the fall. I think the primary objective of that is to try to get as much key provisions in the UAPDA passed out of the conference committee in the National Defense Authorization Act, and then give whoever the next president is kind of the mandate to appoint or to nominate those members of the review board and sort of, you know, shift into a different regime.
Let's pick some of those points out then. And you've very nicely set up my next four or five questions, so thank you for that. So you mentioned that UAPDA was gutted last year. Namely, there's a lot to it, but the two big hitters are that presidential review board, where there would be nine nominated expertise, you know, that would be looking to take through all the records and try and look, work out what's here, what can we disclose, how do we do this? And the second was eminent domain, where essentially the government can go in and take back anything they see fit related to UAP. And that could be if Matt Pines has a piece of craft alleged to be given to him from Jacques Vallée, they could come into your house, take it, and you can't do anything about it. But also big private aerospace, people at Brandon Fugle and Skinwalker Ranch, they can come in, take your stuff, and you can't say no. Those are gone. Those were gone, but they're back in this time. The bill's going through exactly the same as it was before. Does that make sense to you, putting the bill back through exactly the same?
Well, I mean, it's all politics and the tactics and the dynamics between the personalities on the sort of Senate Select Committee Intelligence and Senate Armed Services side and their sort of key staffers and the House side. My understanding, and I think some folks have said this, is that, you know, there was a debate about whether we whether the Senate revises or sort of punches up some of the definitions, some of the text. That might require additional wrangling internally on the Senate side to get some of those original co-sponsors on board with those changes, you know, and like anything else, right? Once you've got something that everyone agreed on previously, there's going to be some amount of transaction cost and friction to make any changes. And I think Senator Rounds has stated that, you know, this was about just getting something that they could get over to the House side and say, we're committed to this again. We want to negotiate in good faith. We haven't, you know, moved the ball the way we want to move the ball. And let's like take at least a consensus step forward in this direction. So, you know, far be it from me, you know, watching on the sidelines to sort of second guess those internal political calculations. I think, you know, as written, the UAPDA is would be a milestone, you know, pretty dramatic fashion. I think, you know, obviously you could probably tweak things along the edges, but just getting that passed as is would be a pretty watershed moment. So I would imagine that from the Senate side, that's the overriding objective.
How much does the outcome of the presidential election affect the progress of the bill? As it's trying to go through right now, it seems there's a whole lot going on. And from the outside, the US election is fascinating to watch because it's such a battle of personality rather than policy, as it maybe has been in the past. And I know more about US politics now than I do UK politics. I'm not massively into politics just because how much coverage we see of it on the TV. And it has become this battle of the personalities now between Kamala Harris, Donald Trump. How much do you think that's taking away, or could that potentially help this pass, but then also get this enacted as well?
Yeah, and yeah, I am in the heart of the beast in DC, unfortunately. So the pathologies of our political system are manifested every day. On this topic, I would draw, you know, attention to some of the findings and declarations language in the UAPDA itself, which mentioned that you know, evidence indicates, you know, that, you know, legislative and executive oversight has otherwise been lacking on these programs. So elected officials in the executive branch have not been briefed in. There are two, you know, elected officials in the executive branch, the president and the vice president. So that implies to me, the Senate is making a clear statement that from the evidence and testimony that they've been given, that they've inspected, that motivated the UAPDA, and they, you know, codify that in a pretty stark language, you know, when they set that out in the findings and declarations, like each one of those, you know, bullet points carries a lot of weight and sending a pretty strong signal. And a key piece of that signal was essentially that the current vice president, now the nominee for the Democratic Party, has not been read in, has not been made aware of these programs. That's essentially what the Senate said. Now, I can't speak for, you know, Vice President Harris in terms of how she might feel about that. I don't know if she's been, you know, told about that or how much she has any awareness of the subject. I think she, you know, I think my default is that she doesn't know a whole lot, even though she was on the Intelligence Committee. She was a relatively junior member. you know, that from any, I think a large portion of the political motivation here on both the Senate side and the potentially in the White House side is a sense of, wait, we're supposed to know these things. We are the ones in charge. I need to know these things. I am in charge. It's an ego thing. It's a power thing. It's a first order, right? And yeah. So I can imagine, you know, if it's President Harris who gets, or Vice President Harris who wins the election, that an element of that might be in play, and she, you know, might decide to you know, assert herself in a fashion that she hasn't yet. Donald Trump, you know, is a wild card on almost any topic. So it's hard for me to, handicap what a disclosure process would look like under sort of either scenario. I think there are you know, elements of this, though, that are, you know, going to take place. I think the reason why the UAPDA is important is, from the Senate's perspective, is it kind of helps them get this hot potato and sort of toss it off to an independent group, right? And yeah. That also helps the White House, right? It's sort of it's a technocratic kind of bureaucratic maneuver to essentially take a very fraught, very difficult, very sort of politically sensitive and national security sensitive issue and set up like a separate, independent structure, nominally part of the executive branch, but having sort of an independent status, you know, authorities to to declassify with the president's sort of override, you know, mandate, you know, testimony, under penalty of perjury, give, request subpoenas, and obviously inspect facilities and make disposition determinations on any technologies of unknown origin and biological materials associated with that. And so I think everyone has an alignment of interest to a certain extent at the political layer to establish this independent group and sort of, you know, hand this hot potato off to that group. And then have them kind of charged with, you know, really getting to the bottom of it, coming up with this controlled disclosure campaign plan, sort of a phased, more deliberative disclosure process. And then questions that come to the White House or questions that come to the Senate can just be sort of punted over to this review board. There's a process. There's a timeline. We got serious people. They're looking at it. You know, I can sort of, you know, punt that question.
So, like you say, Kamala Harris, we don't know. If she gets in, that's to be decided what she would do and how she would handle it, and appreciate the way you've put that across. Trump has had 4 years previously in the presidency, as we all know. And he famously, I think the peak of his UFO commentary was when he done that interview with Don Jr. And I remember the famous, like, they had the cliffhanger moment where he was like, you know, Roswell, you know, oh, I've seen things and it's interesting. That was about as far as he went, though, with that. And, you know, he mentions the pilots and the military servicemen and women, and they should be trusted. But he still was relatively dismissive, other than saying it's interesting. What could you see being different in a second term, if anything at all?
I think a lot could be different. I think a lot depends on what happens in the outside game. As mentioned, there's an inside game and an outside game. Inside game is, you know, the legislation, the establishment of this review board. Obviously the National Archives has their repository that they're putting together. And so that will sort of proceed, I think, in an incremental fashion. But the sort of nonlinear changes to the political environment that politicians then have to respond to could come, you know, in a separate track. And so that, that I don't think is necessarily something that, you know, the president or the former president will be determining, but they could provide an anchor point to then react to try to seize political advantage, depending on how they want to frame their response. And so if there are other senior officials, former officials that come out and say things along the same lines that David Grush, Carl Nell have said, and it elevates it, you know, to a, like a big question mark, then, you know, you could see politicians like Trump that want to, you know, try to take any advantage they can out of like a media cycle or put themselves in a position of political advantage could seize on that. So that's like in the context of the current campaign.
Yeah.
Obviously if he wins and he's president, you know, the determinations you make as president on any topic are, you know, even someone as potentially mercurial as Trump, are often grounded on like core national security interests. You know, no one wants to be accused, and certainly no one wants to have to manage a crisis on their watch. That's usually the first order of business when you're in charge, is you try not to blow things up. You try not to have things get chaotic while you're responsible, you know, regardless of the topic. And so I think the overriding prerogative of any president is always going to be, okay, how do I manage this process? How do I control whatever this issue is? What are the levers that I can control? What are the levers that I can't control? And then how can I manage this and maintain some semblance of stability in whatever the scenario? So I would assume it would be something like that. I do not anticipate even a Trump presidency sort of just dropping a disclosure bomb, right? Yeah. So the institutional prerogatives of the executive resist that, even despite whatever personality traits hold that office. So that would be, I think, my default. But there could be sort of nonlinear changes in the external environment that politicians have to react to that could occur now or could occur, when they're holding that office.
So as we record this, we're about 11 days away from that book from Lou Elizondo finally being released. It's called Imminent. When this podcast comes out, Matt, it'll be a few days probably or a week to go before it comes out. You mentioned due to the leak, you've read the first few chapters. Mm-hmm. And I've stated previously, I haven't. I did ask Lou how he felt about people discussing it when it had leaked and whatnot, and he had no issue with that because he said, as someone who himself would advocate transparency, he understands it would be counterproductive to then tell people not to talk about it. So I was more than happy with that from him. I've stayed away from it, though, until it comes out. It's not too long to go, but I wonder, do you feel this is going in? You sound like this is how you feel. It's going to trigger momentum. And do you think it's a deliberate strategic move to release this book now and with the content you expect it to have and from what you've read so far?
Yeah, certainly. And just on that question, I think, everyone has a moral obligation if they're going to talk about the book or read its excerpts to buy the book, maybe buy multiple copies. So just as a point there, and I've got two pre-orders.
Nice.
And so I think at least... in terms of a strategic move, right? I think he sort of telegraphed this maybe 2-3 years ago, right? When he was, positioning himself to sort of, okay, go from the podcast circuit, where he could sort of talk very indirectly or obliquely, or kind of just coming up to certain lines and just sort of, frame a certain narrative structure around this issue. But I think to really, move this forward in a way that he felt he needed to help push it, he needed to get text, in a narrative and then get that through the Dobster process. Mm-hmm. And that's the critical element, because then he knows very clearly, these are the lines that I can and cannot cross, and trying to establish that line as broad as possible. So that when he does interviews, he can state in no uncertain terms, exactly what he puts in the book that was cleared through Dobster. Same thing that sort of David Grush did. And that allows him to, go and do, things like he did with 60 Minutes, but instead of, saying things in a slightly more indirect fashion, he could just kind of come hard in the paint. And someone with his professional bona fides, and now having essentially a media and publishing, team behind him, I don't think we've had that thus far in this broader topic. And it might be supplemented by other folks, sort of endorsing or validating some aspects of his narrative story. So I think it'd be very important. Book. I mean, like anything else in our modern media cycle, right? Like, we are living through pretty highly disruptive and chaotic times. We've had every week you have like a hard pivot in the national narrative on like a critical question, whether it was presidential candidates dropping out, attempted assassinations, stock market sell-offs. You've got every other day you've got something that grips the headlines and makes people panic. Could be a war brewing in the Middle East, the next thing. So you're competing for attention in an environment where there's enormous amounts of events that are popping off daily. So I don't know how it will, propagate in the media cycle, but I think it will have an effect in the minds of key individuals inside DC.
So especially with your background, and I don't want to bastardize these questions because I know I can see the titles in your job and I know the very, very basics of what you do. So I won't pretend to understand, but given your view on the global scale and the climate you mentioned, it seems there's a crisis every single day. The UK right now is a mess. The US is a drama, which would be worthy of a Netflix series. And I don't think you could write one as well. I don't think we're far off getting real life Squid Games happening at this rate. I wouldn't be surprised. Do you feel this would be a good time for disclosure to really ramp up and happen? Or is it a time where it would just get lost in the shuffle?
Well, so my mental model of what you call like the disclosure process is exactly that, as a process. And the way I sort of think about it, and this might be a bit wonky, but you know, I'm a physics sort of math nerd, so this is how I think about things, is you know, social belief formation is a process of sort of you know, ideas spreading through networks, right? And people have a variety of networks. They have sort of personal networks, high trust networks, people that, you know, your family, your immediate close associates, people that you would go and have a beer with, that you would talk with, that you're in a signal chat group. There's like, you know, kind of this, you model kind of the connection points of how you receive information and how any individual sort of forms a belief about any subject. It sort of goes through two different key mechanisms in my mind, and sort of I'll graph this out of the UAP kind of disclosure processes. You know, in any network, you kind of have two key dynamics. You have sort of percolation, which usually happens through clusters of sort of high dense sort of connections. So you have like clusters, say in the UAP community, of people that, you know, talk with each other, they share information, they're all deeply, you know, interested in a particular subject. Information travels through and kind of gets validated among a sort of a small cohort of individuals. And usually there are bridges then that connect different sort of those small local clusters on any given topic. So like you can imagine, if you model like the UAP topic, right, there are sort of UAP podcasts, UAP influencers, then there's sort of people that maybe aren't as public, but also have kind of their high trust network connections to share information, try to validate perspectives on certain things. But those are kind of, so information percolates through those clusters, in a, you know, discrete fashion, kind of. It goes to this one cluster, it spreads, you know, through those links to other key clusters that have sort of interest in this particular subject. And then there's a broad, and there's a separate process of like diffusion, right, which is much more indirect, that sort of you know, diffuses from those high cluster, from those high dense clusters to, you know, indirect connections that aren't part of those clusters. And so that's people that are just sort of casual observers of the UAP subject that aren't a part, they don't regularly watch, you know, UAP podcasts, that don't like follow all the influencers on Twitter, that are just sort of paying attention to whatever happens to kind of diffuse into their information feeds. And so that is sort of how I model this, you know, any topic, but the UAP topic in particular, sort of how people with this information, the folks that want this information to come out, are sort of choosing, you know, both of those mechanisms and trying to figure out which mechanisms to push in different forms. So you can imagine the strategy early on with, say, Lou Elizondo to the Stars Academy, Jim Semivan, going on UFO podcasts, et cetera, was essentially the percolation strategy, right? Which is folks that are already deeply interested in the subject that are positioned to kind of receive this information and kind of digest it and then share it. It spreads through those sort of high trust clustered, you know, networks, but it doesn't really diffuse that much. It diffuses only maybe, you know, indirectly through you know, like 60 Minutes presentations or the occasional New York Times article, the debrief article, these big high profile discrete events that sort of shift the broader Overton window for the larger, you know, social network that's consuming, you know, all sorts of information. So I think it's interplay between seeding certain information to spread through those high trust, to percolate through those high trust networks, and then ever so often kind of shifting the framework that the broader network can digest this information so it can diffuse a little bit further, right? And diffuse it. So that's, I think, how, if I model like this whole process for the last, you know, 8 years or so, it seems to have been kind of a mix and match between those two things. So it seems like there is no one that I've encountered that wants like all this information to come out and wants everyone to believe it tomorrow, right? Because that would be potentially very socially disruptive. If everyone all of a sudden woke up tomorrow and went from not believing this is true to believing this is true, well then, you know, like any other environment, people discount the future based off present information. You could have radical changes to how people discount the future that could lead to, you know, social, economic, financial disruptions. So the best case scenario is to, you know, how to slowly sort of acculturate different parts of the social network to this information. Folks that are disposed to it, you know, naturally by their psychological inclinations, their, you know, personal experiences, et cetera, you know, they can kind of get on board first and faster without as much disruption to their, you know, to the worldview, to their personal sort of lifestyles, and then, you know, a broader diffusion strategy for the rest of the population. So that seems to be what's been happening, and sort of my assumption is that will continue for the next few years.
I think that makes sense, and I think we do need to look at years still in terms of some sort of process. I still think James Webb Telescope will play a part in that process, and if you want to to train a global population that there may be something here or an NHI or whatever you want to call it, then finding something really far away and confirming we have found something really far away, but not saying it's coming here. Literally, we've found pollution and lights on a planet, you know, in distant star system. Then the questions naturally start to come from people that, oh, so are, there are aliens. Well, yeah, but they're on a different planet. They're too far away to get to. We can't get to them. Yeah, but could they come here? And then that could be an escalated drip feed, but I could still see the James Webb playing a big part in that. Is that something you could see happening, or is that still too much of a leap?
I mean, a natural and logical course to present information on this subject would be to start with, say, biosignature detection, right, in a distant system. And of course, that would fit the existing scientific paradigm and our research strategy with Kepler, with James Webb, with a number of other kind of astronomical projects underway, with the explicit objective of detecting biosignatures. So the whole research paradigm that is, you know, fully institutionalized and normalized to search for life in other star systems, to identify biosignatures, to understand kind of the chemical and biological precursors to life, looking at possibilities of panspermia, inspecting formations on Mars and Europa and meteorites. That would be like a very obvious first step. And then it would be a natural step from that to detection of technosignatures, right? Whether that's fast burst, whether it's a certain characteristic signal or a structure like a megastructure detection around a distant system. And that would maybe set like the analytic and cultural frame for then, okay, if there are technosignatures and advanced civilizations that we can see in the distance, well, you know, it's a natural inference to then raise the question, well, maybe they've already sent probes here. Maybe they've already sent elements of their civilization to our system. And maybe, and how long have they been here? And what have they been doing? That would be a natural sort of sequence. I don't know if that is the sequence that's going to play out. I'm not sure there is a in a position to orchestrate, you know, that sequence of revelations in a controlled manner so that the entire astronomical and research community is basically told, first you detect this and then you detect this. Mm-hmm. At least my understanding, I've looked and I've talked to a number of people, is this, you know, so the scientific community and lots of these communities, you know, these aren't systems that would just really, you know, respond to a top-down directive, and aren't necessarily good at keeping those sorts of secrets longer term, and, you know, sticking to a coordinated plan between, you know, thousands of individual researchers all with their own telescopes. So it is a natural sequence. If you were like in a position to like master orchestrate a sequence for maximal social digestion of this information, but it might be just be the case that our current institution scientific frameworks and bureaucracies just can't actually execute that like ideal sequence. And so what we might get is something different. We might get is something a bit more haphazard, a bit more jumpy. I mean, if you just look at the David Grush revelations, right? Before that, a priori expectation would be they would first just set up this independent group inside the Pentagon, independent in air quotes, group inside the Pentagon to say they're taking it seriously, investigate pilot reports, try to reduce the stigma and the taboo. Say we're going to integrate, you know, multiple sensors with the specific sort of phenomenology kind of requirements built into the collection process, and we're going to investigate it. We're going to, you know, be serious about it. We're going to report it to Congress. We're going to, you know, gradually make it, you know, a thing we can talk about in terms of objects displaying anomalous capabilities and a formal procedural, you know, analytic and reporting, you know, framework around that, and then gradually get to the point that we can say, yeah, we're actually seeing real things that travel, you know, and display anomalous properties, and we assess that it's not in the inventory of our adversaries, and it's not a secret U.S. government program, you know, .. right? Which is sort of kind of, I think, the track. And then, of course, David Grush comes in and says, you know, legacy programs, you know, crash retrievals, bodies, and kind of scramble that narrative. Right. It wasn't like that was a linear progression. That was a nonlinear jump. Right.
Yeah.
And I just think, you know, this is the way things work out. Like history is contingent and messy, and there's no master plan. But I think there is a directional effort to, you know, get some of this information to be more widely accepted. But I don't think my expectation at this moment is it's not going to necessarily follow this, you know, what you might draw up on a whiteboard in terms of this astrophysical discovery. Oh, that opens up people's minds, and then they can absorb this other information. It might be a bit more, nope, we're just in that, we just jump into that conversation directly.
So one of the things, or two of the things that may help then, are those documentaries you mentioned. And this is quite a big discussion point, or has been an underlying discussion point in the UFO community now for a while. And I can't remember the first time it came up. You mentioned two documentaries coming out, one of which I'm assuming is going to be James Fox, The Program, which we know is due, I think it's going to be probably early next year before we see that, just with James putting out his updates and whatnot. Looking like it's going to have first-hand witnesses, we hope, from some of these programs. I'm guessing in that shadowy background sort of thing we're used to on TV shows, like when Bob Lazar first came out, for example, and discussing perhaps their roles. That would be incredibly interesting. But you did mention a second, and I've seen loads of speculation online, Matthew, as to what that second documentary would be. Is that something you can elaborate on?
I don't think I can share too many details about it. I'm not in it, but the information about it was shared in strict confidence. So I'll just say that I'm aware that there is a very serious second documentary. It might have overlap with James Fox's documentary, which I think will be very compelling on its own right, at least my understanding. I know he's working very hard on it as a documentarian. It takes a lot of work.
Yeah.
I believe there's a second documentary in the works. The timeline is, you know, like any documentary, kind of subject to revision, but it is, you know, on track, you know, sometime this year is my understanding. Obviously those things could be delayed. And we'll have individuals, you know, with serious credentials talking about the subject in ways that haven't been spoken of publicly before. That's my understanding.
I'm going to really annoy people here and say that on that documentary that I'm aware of, when you mentioned before that with media projects, they can be announced before anything even happens, and then things can happen that they don't even end up seeing the light of day. We know there have been movies made that are literally filmed and with $100 million budgets that are then scrapped for various reasons. So I think it's one, from what I've heard, people shouldn't be too surprised if it didn't come out, or at least there's a massive delay on it.
Yeah, no, I mean, I am not,
people saying,
I'm not a part of the production process, and I think
me neither. No,
these
me
sorts
neither.
Of things can swing week to week, right? So all I'm aware is that there is a serious effort underway with serious people involved, and the objective is to obviously push out a documentary. You know, beyond that, right, things can change. So that's where I would leave
it. And I think with what we're talking about, it must be incredibly difficult to get something like this up and out. Just for James Fox to do what he does on his own, to get the people he is trying to get and hopes to get on screen for these, must be so difficult. Where look how hard it was for Grush to do what he done. And he done it so well, but look at the blowback on it across the board. And for James Fox to now have to go and try and find multiple Grushes, essentially, to go on camera and documentary form, that must be difficult. So again, for anyone else trying to do that, it might be a bigger production, it could be a bigger budget, there could be more people involved, in which case that may make things more difficult or easier, I don't know. But yeah, that second documentary, like I've heard, is, I've seen some folks suggest maybe kind of smaller names, smaller entities being involved, and like you say, I don't think that's it. I think it's a much bigger
I'm sure there's multiple documentaries, you know, on the side.
There are loads coming out, but
the one I was thinking of, you know, I would put it on par with, you know, James Fox effort.
So yeah, looking forward to that, but definitely with James is coming out 100%, I think that could be a big leap. So touching again, you mentioned catastrophic disclosure before. I've just spoken a few nights ago to Danny Sheehan, and I brought up catastrophic disclosure to him because he mentioned one of the questions I'd asked him previously, he brought up being asked to sign NDAs, and he refused to do so. I asked him off the back of, you know, catastrophic disclosure, what's his understanding of that, given he won't sign the NDAs for the people who are worried about it, as to what they would think. And again, from his point of view, similar to what you mentioned, Matt, he's talking about, you know, the banking systems would suffer, that our societal fabric, as we know it, would change. People waking up next morning, that would be a huge thing in people's mindsets. the big tech companies, you know, fuel would be tech companies, aerospace, whatever, there's going to be an impact. So I wonder, with the revelation that these shadow programs exist, how do you see it, maybe one or two, three big ways, impacting society the most?
That is all for part one. Part two will be out in the next couple of days. You can listen to this episode already in full, ad-free and with no sponsors for less than the price of a coffee. If you head on over to Patreon or Apple, you can subscribe to the podcast for less than the price of a coffee or take up the 2 weeks free trial that are available on those platforms. You can head on over to Spotify and search That UFO Podcast Premium and get access to this episode in full, no adverts, no sponsorships, and also with some extra bonus content as well. Thanks for listening, folks.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Going to the gym can be discouraging, especially if you're putting in the work but barely seeing changes. But with Tonal, you can actually see your progress with every workout. Tonal provides the convenience of a full gym and the expertise of a personal trainer anytime at home with one sleek system. Designed to reduce your mental load, Tonal is the ultimate strength training system, helping you focus less on workout planning and more on getting results. No more second-guessing your technique. Tonal gives you real-time coaching cues to dial in your form and help you lift safely and effectively. After a quick assessment, Tonal sets the optimal weight for every move and adjusts in 1 pound increments as you get stronger, so you're always challenged. Tonal lets you choose from a variety of expert-led workouts, from strength to arrow hit to yoga and mobility, to keep you coming back for more. For a limited time, go to Tonal.com to get $500 off your Tonal purchase plus a free 4-year warranty. That's Tonal.com for $500 off plus a free 4-year warranty. Tonal.com.